Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, it's Saturday morning. It's Louis Armstrong, the great Satchmo, singing to us, "What a Wonderful World." And today we've got my fellow RCR host, Jaspreet Bapparai, coming to sit in the psychotherapist chair. Jaspreet, big, big welcome.
Thank you, Jerry. Good to be here. I think I'm apprehensive about what comes next.
Every guest that comes on has to go, maybe. Well, just so the listeners know, there's no need for you to talk about anything you don't want to talk about. So it's completely in your control what you share. So that's part of the safety that we do here. So listeners will probably know you really well, Jaspreet, but just in case they don't, I'm going to give you my brief introduction to you. I met Jaspreet when we were both VFF coordinators, and then you took on the role of being a regional coordinator, and then you took on the role of running for council, and then you took on RCR. I actually don't quite know how you do all that you do, Jaspreet. And I felt that, you know, right from the beginning, and I am in awe of how much you managed to get done. So do you want to give anything else as an introduction to the listeners?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And you asked, how do I get it done? Let's say not very gracefully. The domestic goddess scorecard has been well and truly thrown into the dustbin. It is done with everything, you know. I guess it reached a stage where I decided I have to look at my priorities. And on one side was all of this, you know, the domesticity and everything else that goes with it. But the other side were my children. And my children are really young. I'm an older mom. I'm 45. And my kids are 7 and 9. So I looked at them and I was like, yeah, nothing like a reality check on this one. And sort of none of us have planned this. I think we have all found ourselves in a space for which there has been no book, no guide on what to do, especially, you know, 2021 to 2023. And when I have just rolled with the punches, pretty much. There has been no deep foresight or planning or strategy, nothing. It's just been take each day as it comes and just roll with it.
Yeah, I mean, ain't that the truth? And well, I think a lot about how you keep stepping up. And I think this brings us actually to one of the reasons for this show. And I often do it at the end, and sometimes I forget. So I'm going to do it at the beginning. There's two kind of questions that I think might be of interest to listeners and certainly are of interest to me, which is, you know, what gets you out of bed in the morning and how do you deal with stress and trauma when it comes your way? So the first one, what gets you out of bed in the morning? What gives you the mojo to get up and out of bed in the morning? And how do you, yeah, what drives you?
Well, I find myself in this position, Jerry. Most people would know I migrated to New Zealand 2009, my husband and I. I didn't have children then. It's been just over 15 years now in the country. And as a migrant, you know, especially the last few years as a migrant, you give up so much. Births, deaths, marriages, funerals, so many of those have just not been able to attend. There are people who are new ones who are now photographs. Just photographs somewhere, people in flesh and blood that I haven't been able to be there around in their final moments. And then when you are out here, you've missed all of that. You've got to make what you have chosen good, worth it,
yeah,
really worth it. My husband used to say that when we had first started dairy farming, and I took that thing he said to heart. You know, he says, I don't get up at 3:50 in the morning, 5 days a week to do a mediocre job. That's when we were farming, and that's all we were doing at that point. Life is sort of a mishmash right now. And I took that to heart. And that's the same thing. We've given up so much to be here. Got to make this worth it. And that's pretty much what's driven me, besides, of course, my kids and where are we heading to?
Mm.
That's, you know, our paths crossed during these last 4 years, the COVID era, as I call them.
Yeah.
It had to be worth it, whatever we were here in for.
Well, I bet neither of us would ever have envisaged that we'd be sitting here on RCR doing our own radio shows.
No, not. I still remember the plane circling over Auckland, 2009, August early, when I was landing here for the first time. There was a bit of cloud, and we were circling and circling, pilot was trying to get a break in the clouds. And I look at this little Emerald Isle as I saw it down, and I was like, wow, what am I doing here? This is quite the leap of faith. So I can tell you, when I landed here, this was nowhere in the reckoning. It still feels unreal, to be honest.
Well, I do wonder, because I came over in the middle of COVID from England, because I actually came over to protect my grandson. I wanted to be another body standing in the door saying, over my dead body, will you get to my grandson? That was my sole motivation, really. And there is a sense of dislocation, and I think it's really big. I think we can often underestimate that, the power of that. I only knew about it because when I was four, I was dislocated from New Zealand to England, and it took me 58 years to get back.
Yeah, that's quite some dislocation. To be honest, I've been dislocated quite a few times in my life. Moving every 2 years, being the daughter of an Indian Army infantry officer. So I changed 7 or 8 schools,
yes.
2 universities.
Yes.
So I am used to being dislocated often, and yeah, finding my own place,
yeah,
wherever we used to land.
Well, we'll come on to that part of your life in a bit, and I'm very interested in that part of your life. But I'm still thinking about that first bit about, what gets you out of bed. And I think I'm hearing you say there are kind of 3 things going on. One is, having made the move, there's a bloody-minded determination to make it work, right? And I love that phrase of your husband, I don't get up at 3:15 in the morning to do a mediocre job. I think that's a beautiful saying. I like that.
Yeah, he doesn't come out with gems, as I say, very often, but that's one line of his that I've taken to heart. Yeah, it is true.
Yeah. And then there's your children, and I completely understand that, and that's such a primal driving force within us. I think it's even more of a drive for women than men. I think there's no disputing the fact that whilst men have often been seen to leave families, it's very rare for a woman to. And when it does, it's a big, society looks at that and says, that's not right, And it's not right if either parents leave. Of course it's not. I'm not trying to make out some new kind of different rules between men and women. But what I'm saying is that instinctive get up and go for the service of your children, it's only you that's responsible, right? You're responsible for bringing those people in.
100%. And, completely concur with what you say, Jerry. But along with that, and that's not to say, motherhood is easy for anyone, but my path to motherhood was very hard. It took me a lot of science there to have my daughter. And for about nearly a decade of my life, I identified myself with my infertility, which was, they said undiagnosed, they didn't have a cause for it. So my path to motherhood was not easy.
Wow.
And that doesn't change how a mother feels. Let me qualify it by that. Regardless of whether your path was easy or not, we all, the instinct to save your cubs is different. But yeah, a lot of my life, a good decade from my mid-20s to my mid-30s, I had to find reserves deep within myself, because I was determined to have children, but there were a lot of setbacks for me. And that was, a rough decade. Let's put it that way.
Wow, that sounds like you've been on quite a journey with that.
I wouldn't wish it on anyone, not my worst enemy. But hey, then I had my son without any trouble, without even virtually trying to. So what do I know? I had one child via IVF and a surprise child, just naturally. So I've been blessed. No complaints.
Wonderful. Oh, what a beautiful story. I mean, just so beautiful. And isn't fertility one of the great mysteries?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. Yeah.
It's like, I know some people think they made their children, but that's a bit weird. I mean, it's one of those rare moments, isn't it, where we get to participate in the very act of creation. And the growing of a child in a woman's womb is a continual mystery to me. And I'm in awe of it, actually, as a bloke. I'm in awe of it.
Circle of life carries on. And regardless of how you've become a parent, a mother, a father, it's, I think we're all driven by the same primal instinct somewhere to protect our cubs.
I think I was most shocked by the instinct for my one and only, currently only, although I'm nagging my other two children to get busy, but my only grandson, my only grandchild. And I was absolutely knocked off my block when he arrived, even though he was in New Zealand being born and I was in the UK. There was this instant and immediate primitive visceral kind of connection. And I really didn't think I was ready to be a grandparent. I feared it, I think, but actually, you know, the bond, it was overwhelming because it was this real sense of life continuing.
Yeah.
Without me doing anything, it was just, I'm stuck for words. And it's unbelievable, really.
I've seen it with my parents, my husband's parents, and, you know, the feelings that grandparents have for children. And yeah, I remember my parents being here in New Zealand. They had come down when my daughter was to be born, and they probably saw her a few minutes, probably, I think, about 15, 20 minutes after she was born. Yeah, that bond is something else. My daughter was my parents' first grandchild. And till today, when she talks to my mom on the phone, especially, it's like, "Mom, can you leave the room?" "Yep, I will."
There's something in that as well about the bond between the grandparent and the grandchild, the mother and the child, but also from the child to the grandparent. The amazing ease with which my grandson just wanders into our house when we pick him up from school, which we're lucky to be able to do a couple of times a week. And he just walks in as if he's the king of the house and he owns us and he owns it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. And I've seen my kids, my army officer, retired army officer dad, very firm person, just absolute putty in their hands.
Yeah. So, yes, the migrant coming over in 2009, the children and the immense determination, by the sound of it, just breed, I'm picking up, as ever with you, an immense sense of willfulness.
Pig-headedness, some would call it, but yeah.
Yeah. And that brings us really to the third reason that you said that gets you out of bed, which is, you know, what's going on these days, which is also probably very, you know, for me, it's very connected with my grandson. And I imagine for you, it's connected with your children as well, that there is this sense of how do we protect their future?
Yes. The, you know, the most vulnerable of the citizens, even if you look at it from a country perspective, because I'd like my children to identify not just as my kids, their own little personalities, the persons in themselves. They are the most defenseless, voiceless of our citizens. How well have we treated them over the last few years? Not well at all, in my opinion.
Well, there's been no thought for them whatsoever. They haven't even entered onto the radar screen of the lawmakers, of the rule makers, and of the people who think they have a right to decide how other human beings should live their lives, which is an abrogation of the natural way. I don't want to get too preachy about this, but when we were talking about the miracle of children, the miracle of creation, I feel as if those are moments when we are invited to participate in a divine behavior. We are partners with a divine being, however people describe that. They might call it the universe, they might call it God. However they describe that word, there's this moment where we, as it were, are invited, the hand is held out to us, and we're invited to participate in creation and to be invited, whether as a father or a mother or a grandparent or even an aunt or an uncle. You know, it's there through the blood, you know. And so there is this remarkable essence that is carried somewhere in the blood, I believe. And this is what has been attacked, has been the very blood of humanity, with bypassing all our natural defenses and injecting something so that they can bypass the natural defenses, all the macrophages, all the immune defenses of the nasal passages. Of every single orifice in the human body has an army of defenders to protect our integrity. And then medicalization comes along and they think they can stick a needle inside us and bypass that natural defense. And this is where the divine, the blood, the partnership, this is where I got hit in 2020. This is something in me stirred up and said, wrong, 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 wrong. This, something's deeply, deeply wrong. And I know this program is meant to be about you, but I do want to share with you some of my...
You put it far better than I would, Jerry. You're a great wordsmith. I looked around me and I was stunned. There was no one speaking up at that, you know, the very initial days, initial months. Then, of course, things gather speed and others joined in. But I would look around me and look at my daughter. Was that time attending a kindergarten. She turned 5 during the first lockdown in March of 2020. And these are parents who look for stainless steel bottles, the best car seats, everything. And no one was questioning anything. And I was trying to have these conversations then with people. This is, well, you know, I'm talking June, July, that winter of 2020. No one was having these conversations at all. And I wondered what has happened to us. How did those instincts get so, you know, buried somewhere? Because they did come up. They did resurface after a while. But for a while, they were completely buried and people were just ignoring it, just not wanting to look there. There's this whole ostrich syndrome, head in the sand, not going to talk about it. Let's brush it on. We've become, I think, what with social media, Twitter, and all of these things, it's short, instantaneous gratification. We are only looking at what's right under our noses. No one is looking at long-term down the road. What's going to happen there? And yeah, my heart broke for so many children around us seeing here what was happening. But as a parent, you know, you also have to maintain that line. If I choose to raise my children in a certain way, I have to afford that same opportunity to another parent. I cannot be interfering there. But even conversations are not welcome. And I really wonder what's happened to us. Why don't we as adults have this debate of ideas? And nope, nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one of the reasons I do this show is because I refuse to let what happened be brushed under the carpet, and I refuse to let people carry on as if nothing happened, you know. And I do think that as more and more is becoming more public, as people are realizing that something terrible has happened, it's going to be very tough for people, isn't it, to face the fact that they went along with supposedly trustworthy agencies. And they put their kids through things that children should never have been put through.
For the most people, I mean, I just think they're just good, trusting people, which when I think of it, what does that put me as a cynical, untrusting person? But yeah, most people who went along were good, trusting people who vested their complete trust in authority, trusting them to do the right thing. So I completely agree. There cannot be any sweeping of this under the carpet. Because you cannot move on unless the issue has been addressed. If you're just trying to keep putting a Band-Aid over it, the wound is just going to fester. Accountability has to happen. Because otherwise, what was all of these last few years, what were they worth then? If you just go along, oh, right, minor, you know, blip in the road, nothing much happened. No, something happened and someone has to pay for it.
Yeah. And I think it's not a good feeling. I think we're talking in the Psycho Babble panel that I convene every month or so. And the Psycho Babble panel has a child psychologist on it, Ros Neelan Cook. And, you know, she lost everything for daring to speak out in Australia for saying, the children, what are you doing to the children? The children are going to suffer. And we've got children growing up not able to recognize facial indicators because they were denied that with even their mothers wearing masks. And vital stages of psychological development being passed over without the necessary information being given to the brain. And these are, to get these things at a later age is tedious and slow. I mean, it's like when a child is growing very, very young and they're taking in everything so amazingly. And then to have these blank faces,
yeah,
it is to have denied them human recognition. They won't be able to read the emotions of the people they're talking to. And it's going to be the work of decades, I believe, to put right just that one harm. That we're talking about one of about 100 different harms that were done.
And the evidence is there. You have teachers saying kids are coming to school now without the proper language skills, having passed those milestones that would be expected. And how can you with those masks on? And yeah, that's why I say the accountability has to be there. This was deliberately done. There was, you know, someone asked me once, why do you still do this? Why do you still continue? When all of this, we knew the mandates would come and we knew all of this was going to happen. The only point of doing this for me personally was the fact that when a time comes when some are brought to account, they cannot say they didn't know so. They were told so hundreds and thousands of times.
Yeah.
Never let there be a moment where those guilty can get away scot-free saying that, oh, we didn't know.
No.
You chose to ignore the voices. That's what you did. And that's why we spoke up.
And that is going to be a terrible, terrible truth for them to face psychologically. I dread to think, and I've been saying for almost 2.5 years now, I've been saying, what worries me is not that people seem unaware. What really worries me is when they become aware.
Yeah.
That scares me. And I want to make sure that I and all our listeners are going to be there to catch these people, because they're going to be falling, not from COVID. They're going to be falling from trauma. They're going to be falling from despair. They're going to be falling from self-hate. There's going to be so much going on for people that we need to create a new space in society for people to speak of their
betrayal.
Yeah, their betrayal. They were no less betrayed than anyone else. We were all in it together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. But coming away from the politics, and that is such a big driver for you, and I want to just acknowledge the fight you do and your beautiful program, Greenwashed with Dawn. I love listening to it. I wish I had more hours in the day to listen to more of it. But whenever I tune in, I just love the... It's not even the information. I just get soothed. But here are two intelligent people talking common sense at last, you know, and it's like balm to my soul to hear other humans talking in a down-to-earth kind of way. And I bet the other listeners would want to join in with me in saying thank you so much for doing that. Just I know it's not easy. I know the amount of time it takes to put on a show, and I definitely know how much work is involved in these programs.
Thank you, Jerry. Very kind. And I'm very grateful to my co-host, John Nicholson, who's been along for the ride with this mad woman who's like, we are not staying quiet about this, John. He's been lovely to work with over the last couple of years, and eternally grateful to him. Thank you.
And, you know, for all that we've lost, and I think the listeners will resonate with this, for all that we've lost, so many of us have found complete new communities, new families, new friends that we would never have met but for all this. And there is a part of me that still wants to meet Jacinda one day and say, you know, I'll have a few choice words for her, but I'll also say, and for all of that, it was because of the terrible things you did that I met some of the best people I've ever met in my whole life.
I agree with you, not the meeting, the Jacinda part, but the fact that, you know, we've crossed paths with people that in another lifetime I've never met. I was a, you know, farming wife and mom, milking cows in the backwaters of, you know, earlier rural Waikato, then rural Southland. I have met more people in these last 3 years than I've met in the previous 12 that I've been in New Zealand.
Yeah. So,
there has been a silver lining to this really dark, ominous cloud.
Yes. And I have a farming image that describes what I think happened. And I've described it as when I first came here to Wanaka, where I'm living. And by the way, where are you, Jaspreet? Just so the listeners can get a geographical handle on you.
I'm not far from you in Southland. I'm now in Invercargill. But yeah, rural Southland has been home for the last 10 years since we moved down from Waikato in early 2015.
Wow.
So coming up to 10 years here now.
And you were up in Waikato before that?
Yeah, we were farming, my husband and I, in Otorohanga.
Otorohanga. Now, I'm still learning New Zealand geography and names, but I was actually born in Waikato. I was born up in a little tiny place called Mangakino. Is that anywhere near where you were?
Yeah, Mangakino. We used to, you know, go via that, heading to Taupo for a day out off the farm. And Mangakino itself, it's a really quiet, sleepy place. The one gas station had also, I think, closed down when we were there. So I won't ask you which year you were born there, but was your family farming there, Jerry?
No, I was born in 57. And my father came over as a 10-pound pom, and he came on the boats with my mother, and he got a job working on the Waikato Dam at Mangakino. So that dam has his handiwork on it, you know, and I love the feeling. There were lots that my dad didn't get right in his life, but that was something that I'm very proud. I'm proud of lots of things of him, but one thing I'm proud of is that Kiwis are still getting their electricity because of my dad.
Excellent.
He didn't do it on his own, but he was part of the team, you know.
Part of the team.
Yeah. So Mangakino, and so you came to Waikato, you come down to Invercargill and Southlands. Why did you come to New Zealand? I'm always fascinated by that. What brought you over here?
Two things. One was when you looked around, because this was 2008, you know, we're talking of the second or in my lifetime, the global financial crisis that was happening there, subprime loans. Both my husband and I were in banking. I was with a non-banking arm of the Citibank called the City Financial, then another non-banking financial corporation in India. And we were both getting a bit sick and tired of the financial sector. And we come from Punjab. So we are Sikhs, a small minority religion in India, and Punjab. So if I have to describe something, it's when I was growing up, it was wheat fields as far as the horizon, golden, till where the eye could see. So you can take Punjabi out of Punjab, they say. You can't take Punjab out of the Punjabi. And it was farming that got us here. So my husband had made the transition from urban banking to rural insurance in India. And my father-in-law, who was himself a retired rural banker, the general manager, he said, I can see what you're doing. But he said, if you want to go farming, there's no future for farming in India. And he's right. In Punjab, you know, the land is very expensive. There's a pressure for housing in a country of nearly 1.5 billion. So you can't beat inflation farming land that pricey. And my husband did want to go large-scale farming. So we looked around, and much of my husband's family is in North America. But again, out there, it is the subsidies that actually drive farming. Now, my father-in-law was a rural bank manager, and we saw how subsidies in Punjab even were the death of productivity. And New Zealand had no subsidies. This was a land where farming stood up on its own 2 feet, unpropped by anything else. And that was the first one. Small country, there was a skill shortage list by Immigration New Zealand where they were looking for dairy farm workers, and I think it still is. But we looked around and said, right, there's no subsidies here. There is a skill shortlist under which we might qualify. And the last one, which is for me was the most important one, I think, was we didn't know a soul in this country. So that was Fabulous. So in case we fell flat on our faces, there'd be no one to say, I told you so. We didn't know a soul here. So my husband came earlier in February of 2009. And once because I told him, I said, look, I'm not getting rid of my job. I'm happy here. And I was, you know, my brother, father, everyone in the army, no one in my family had immigrated. So I had a pretty comfortable life there and I didn't want to move. And I said, look, you go first. You see how you like it. And come July, when he said, look, I've landed the job with this guy in Waikato. I really enjoy it. Come on over. So I handed in my notice, put the cars for sale, bits and pieces, and came out here early August of that year. So that's how we landed. And a month later, this girl who had never pushed anything beyond a pen in her life found myself milking cows. Gosh, that was a very steep learning curve, Jerry.
Oh, I'd love to be a spider on the wall watching that.
Oh, I sent a picture one day. I took a selfie and I sent it to my dad. And of course, it was the opposite season. So I come from Delhi, where the temperature was hitting 50 degrees at that point in time. Punjab is just to the north of New Delhi. And I come here to Waikato, where it was 3 or 4 degrees. And the picture that I clicked and sent Dad, he replies back saying that, are you wearing every single thing in your wardrobe that you possess? Because I was freezing. And now I'm used to Southland, or Waikato seems positively tropical. But at that point, I didn't know what had hit me. Honestly.
Wow.
It was, yeah. But we've had, you know, we've been very lucky. In 15 years, we've just had 3 employers. So great working relationships. And the gentleman with whom we first landed a job in Waikato, we are still friends to this day. Spent 6 years with him. And yeah, he was a very patient. My husband, of course, has, you know, coming from farming stock, as do I, but I didn't have the knack for the practical work at all. The affinity that he had. My husband was in his element and there I was struggling to cope somehow. And yeah, we managed it. But let's just say I had a very, very steep learning curve, to the point where I remember once our old boss, Malcolm, yelling at me as trying to get some cows that had escaped. He goes, Jaspreet, you run around a cow, not behind a cow. I was like, thank you. Yeah, it's quite humbling.
What do you mean? Explain that. You're around a cow.
I was chasing a cow. That cow's never going to stop. I was supposed to go around a cow to get it to come around. Yeah, a very steep learning curve, as I say, Jerry.
Didn't you have dogs to do that?
No. There was no dogs there. None. I did get a dog, a retired sheepdog. I remember that someone was selling in Tiquity, not far from us. And he was my companion until he passed there. And yeah, that's another thing. I adore dogs, big dogs.
Oh, are dogs good with cows?
It depends how good the training that's gone into them is, Jerry.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And the retired sheepdogs, because a dairy farm is an easy, you know, retirement for a sheepdog. It's relatively flatter. You don't have that much work. Yeah, they're good if well trained.
Mm. Nice. So let's go back to your childhood then, because you've already hinted that you were moving around a lot. So tell me about, you know, what growing up for you as a child was.
A nomad. So Dad has retired from the Indian Army, but he was an infantry officer. So India has very active borders. You know, you've got Pakistan, China. So Sri Lanka, but of course there's a bit of a sea there. So very active borders. And as an infantryman, you are supposed to be at the border, right, where the action is. And there's obviously chances where you can they call it a peace station. You can stay somewhere, say in Delhi, if your husband is in the northeast at the China border. But my mom, being my mom, wanted to be at the station closest to her husband every time. And so we moved schools every 2 years, because even if we were not being able to be posted at exactly where Dad was, we'd be, say, you know, 150, 200, 300 kilometers away. So still better than being 1,000 Ks away in the north of India when he was in the east. So moved schools every 2 years, bar once when Dad was, his battalion was moved to Somalia with the United Nations. That's when I stayed 4 years at a place, which seemed like, wow, 4 years, a long time to have friends and relationships, but otherwise, every 2 years, which meant that you have to go and make your own place in a new community. Because otherwise, I realized very quickly, no one's going to come and make friends with me. These are kids who are continuing in the same school. So I've got to go introduce myself, offer to take part in things and so on. And I got used to it. And India, because of the vast geographical distances, the religions, communities, moving from, say, when we were in Kashmir, post in Kashmir, to the east of India on the China border, completely different. You could be in another continent, It's not remotely like, say, moving from Waikato to Southland. No, it's a different language, different dialect, different physical characteristics, everything different. So it got me used to being somewhat comfortable with change, being uprooted every 2 years.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And did your dad see a great deal of action then? Because he sounds like he was going to be in some very, very tense locations.
Yes, yes. Saw action as infantryman in various places, Kashmir, the China border, in Africa with the United Nations, in Somalia. He did. Mm. So my mom had a little radio. And I remember, especially when dad was in Somalia, listening to the last news, BBC News Bulletin at 10:30 before she would go to bed. And then next morning up at 4:30, again, turning the radio on. So the radio was a constant in our lives. My dad has been a great letter writer, though. A great letter writer. So he has written a letter. Sometimes it would just be a little note for me and my brother, but separate ones, and a letter to mom for every single day he's been away. So she's got tons of letters. I've got a little box of letters from dad. He would make cards, letters, all of it. And sometimes the mail would get stopped. He was in remote places. And then one day you come home from school and the mailbox has like 20 letters. You arrange them by the postmark and then start reading. Yeah.
What a beautiful, heartwarming image that has of you as a young girl waiting for those letters, and also of him in what would have been quite a scary environment, still writing to his family. I love that. There's something really beautiful in that picture you've just shared.
Yeah, I look around, nobody writes letters anymore. But yeah, dad was a voracious letter writer. I look back now and I think how he wrote those, thousands of letters over the days he was away, the years he was away even.
Yeah.
But he did. There was always something to write. We're doing this. And of course, the letters go through a military censor. So you are not supposed to, and as an officer, you know pretty much what you're supposed to write, what you're not to write. But he would still find stuff to write home about every day. It was amazing.
Mm. Yeah. How amazingly, fascinatingly interesting to me that the radio was the lifeline while your father was of connection, really, through working in, fighting in Somalia as a UN peacekeeper, by the sound of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be... There's the radio link. I've been looking for the radio link. Just for you.
Yeah, it was a constant. I seem to remember it always blaring away, breakfast and running to school morning, catching the bus. And before that, mom would have it on. And someone, last minute, get the dog in, do this, turn the lights off, turn the radio off as we leave. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And what about writing? Given the value of the letter writing, are you doing any writing these days? Do you see yourself doing any writing?
Oh, not in the same quantity that he does. If not nearly the same. As I said, I'm still, awestruck how he managed to write something every single day. But then those who have heard me talk, me and Jill and Dawn over the last few years, might say I'm making up for lost time there, Jerry.
Yeah. And it seems that this military family that you came into, it sounds like this family was really close, or tight, as we would say. Is that fair to say?
Very tight. So when you mean beyond us, beyond our family unit? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you have, all of you have husbands in the same circumstances. So they used to be, say, when they were all in Somalia, all the families left behind, you were given something called as SFQ, separated family quarters. So it would be a tight-knit circle there. Everyone, you know, sharing their anxieties sometimes. I remember somebody had to deal with some family issues, someone in their family, relative sick, having to go away 800-900 kilometers. Everyone else rallied around. People would leave their 8, 9, 10-year-olds home alone for 4 or 5 days, knowing that within these separated family quarters, there'd be someone who would do a meal roster. There's a military guard there always in the cantonment who would come and check up. In school, someone would make sure the child's got a tiffin box. Sometimes you would end up having 2 or 3 lunch boxes because multiple people would make sure you get a lunch box when you're hopping onto your school bus. It was a very matter of fact, just stepping up and doing what was needed. I also remember someone who was widowed. She lost her husband in Sri Lanka. And how everyone, I was very little then, I was 5 or 6. And I distinctly remember how everyone rallied. And then the army, of course, takes care of its own. So like the gentlemen who passed in Somalia, there were 7 of them. The military takes care of its own. So their kids were put through schools, universities. There was someone from the battalion representing the battalion at the marriages of their children, especially the daughters' weddings. It continues for decades till the very last minute they need it. So, yeah, that was the sort of circle I have grown up seeing. I remember getting up sometimes on a Sunday and seeing Dad putting on his uniform on a Sunday and wondering, what are you doing? Oh, and this is post-retirement, of course. He says, I saw the Sunday papers. There is a funeral of a, you know, fallen soldier. If there's something within 150, 200 Ks that Dad could drive to and he had enough time, he would be off on a Sunday going to pay his respects. He's been here. I think my Facebook profile photo is my dad with my 2 children at the Anzac parade in Tuatapere last year. Yeah, there's this respect for the uniform and there's a respect for someone who's volunteered to do that job.
Because your father was a brave man protecting the boundaries of your country. And I see you now fighting a different kind of fight, but also protecting the land with your greenwashed program. I see a direct parallel. Is that fair to place that parallel there, Jaspreet?
It is kind of you to say so, Jerry, but very small part. I'm not a blip on what, you know, I've seen men in uniform do. You know, the supreme sacrifice. I've seen that growing up, and this doesn't seem to be a speck on that. But certainly standing up for what was right, certainly standing up for her children and my mom in that, because each time Dad would move in the army, it was 2 years of a peace station where the family would be together, then 2 years of a field posting in the infantry. So my mom had to step up every time, and there would be always a dog, 2 children, herself, and she was working and holding fort for years. When Dad went to Somalia, the first time he was back was well after a year. Or was it 18 months? I forget, it's been 30 years. And she was doing everything. Even when I remember the day the news had come that 7 Indian soldiers killed in an ambush, we didn't know who it was. We didn't know whether Dad was in that or not. Making sure the household still, next morning, everyone, because it was the last news bulletin, she didn't sleep, but the next morning it was like everyone, uniforms on, school, we are all heading off. And she taught in the same school where my brother and I were. Keeping the household ticking. I look back now, she's probably, you know, the silent partner there, making sure nothing, you know, falls off the radar, making sure we do our studies. How she kept mentally strong is something I appreciate now. As a child, you just take your mother for granted.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes there's the trauma of what happens, and sometimes there's the trauma of what could happen as a constant, a worry or a threat. How did your father get through all of that? Because, you know, there's there's so much research now around the trauma that warriors and soldiers have to carry and how they deal with that generates a great deal of interest in my field, in psychotherapy. How did your dad manage with all of that? Was he badly affected? Did he manage to process it well? What happened to him?
Now, if I look back slightly in the history, the Sikhs, you know, if you meet a fellow Sikh, the question is, do you fight or do you farm? A very small part of India's population, less than 2%, a huge part of India's cereal, and the land is also just under 2% of India's land, and the biggest contributor to India's wheat production for such a small state. At one time, there were nearly 18 to 20% of the Indian military and paramilitary forces were the Sikhs. So a warrior clan. And till, I forget which year it was, the Sikhs were allowed a weapon without a license until a few decades ago. So I think that sort of culture is there. I barely know any household in Punjab where at least one of the people is not in uniform. And between my father and my brother at one time, there was someone had always been in uniform in my immediate family for 55 years. Right. So there is that. And not to say that makes things easy, but there is this whole culture in the Sikhs in Punjab about, you know, serving in the military. And other than that, my father's a man of faith, just like me. He does not wear his religion on his, sleeve. Neither do I. But I think his steadfastness in how he conducts his life, you know, morally doing the right thing, is probably what's gotten him through. I remember one particular gentleman who was sent back from Somalia. He'd been through one of these really bad incidents, and for trauma, he was sent back that, you know, the mission is nearly over. Some of these people need to get off the field here. And he came, and so dad had sent some of his personal effects since the mission was nearly winding up with this man. So we come back from school, get off the school bus. Teachers used to go in the same school bus, and this guy is there, and mom invites him in. He's waiting at the doorstep, and he just broke down in tears. He says, ma'am, he's a junior guy. He says, ma'am, when sir came, so dad landed on the scene wherever they were. He says, what we were wondering was, they had been captured, that are we going to be killed straight away before sir comes in, or are we going to be tortured for more info before he comes in? And he says, but there was never a doubt that he would turn up. That was the sort of faith his men had in him. He's led by example. These guys knew that if we are caught here, what this guy was worried about is that he didn't want my dad to put his life in danger, because there were a few of them. And for nothing, if they were going to be killed straight away. He was like, we were waiting, but he says, we always knew he would turn up. And I've seen multiple people over time come, a couple of really retired dads, Man Friday, that, you know, an army officer is given, from our childhood days, come to my wedding 30 years later, each with stories. So I think this is moral conduct, moral compass, and faith. These are the two things I said. Dad has never brought his work home.
Yeah.
He's never spoken to us. It's always been very lighthearted. And yeah, finish everything that's on your plate. I think that's pretty much the only thing he's hates, food being wasted. Everything, elbows off the table, and finish everything that's on your plate. But other than that, yeah, he's a very mild-mannered man, but a man of his word.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And I think the older I grow, the more I appreciate him. And mom. Yeah, holding fort all those times, keeping things on an even keel, never letting us kids feel, even on the days when she didn't know, heading out to work, sending us to school, whether her husband's made it, nothing on her face.
And just going back to that moral compass, which I think has been one of the characteristics most missing in the last 4 years in society as a whole, I've seen a complete lack of moral compass, that there's become a sort of materialistic, selfish, almost pampered society. And I think that's part of the softening up prior to what happened in 2020. And I think I'm just wondering, in terms of the moral compass, what faith did your father have? Was it Sikh? What was the...
Yeah. So we are all Sikhs, S-I-K-H is how you write it.
Yes.
It's pronounced slightly differently in Punjabi than in English. But Sikhism has been our religion, and that's what mine is. And it's a very young religion, breakaway fraction of Hinduism, about 300-400 years ago. And that is what we all subscribe to. And even living here, as I said, if there's the one thing the army taught me, Jerry, it was about being secular. You're surrounded by people from all religions. And that whole thing of not carrying it on your sleeve, because in the Indian army, you identify yourself by a battalion. That is it.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Mm.
You know, when you're on the battlefield, we all bleed red. It doesn't matter what your religion is. So I'm very, very hesitant about talking about religion. It's a very private thing for me.
Yeah.
But it is a huge part of how I live my life.
Yeah.
Yes.
And does that religion happen on your own, or are you able to connect with other members of the Sikh community and share that, or is it very solo?
It is a shared religion, but the community around here is not that huge. So there is no formal Sikh place of worship. It's called the Gurudwara, which means literally translates as a door to the guru. And there's no such premise, premises here. But there are shared services and occasionally in people's homes. But I, for myself, I can say I practice it privately. I've always been like that, even in India. I might go to the temple on a Sunday, very rarely. But otherwise, I would go to offer my prayers in the middle of the day sometime, maybe during my lunch hour, and it would be completely deserted. My connection with the Almighty has been private, always. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Jaspreet. That's really lovely to hear. So, Jaspreet, we're kind of running out of time. I don't believe we've almost hardly begun, but I've got one question left for you, one final question, which is, how do you deal personally with stress or trauma when you're struggling? I ask this of everyone I interview. What works for you to help you manage difficult times?
And there have been quite a few difficult times in the last few years. I've got a handful of great friends, Jerry, who've been great sounding boards to me. So I do speak about whatever. I'm not the sort to keep it to myself. You will see it on my face. If I'm upset, it is there. But there's a very select few with whom I will speak to stuff about. I'll do that. I like time on my own then. So that could be making myself a cup of Indian chai, sitting with a book, or just sitting out staring at nothing. We've got a couple of horses. I don't ride, but I like being around them. We've got a few other pets. But mostly for me, I sort of ruminate over things. I try not to, just quickly jump to, I'm going to do this or that. I sleep over stuff and drink cups of tea over stuff. And then slowly, slowly try to process it.
Mm-hmm.
At times, my parents have been a great sounding board, which is when if I choose to confide. But otherwise, I usually deal with things myself. I have followed this. I think life teaches you a bit of stuff. And now if I'm ever in the midst of something really crazy, it's like being in the eye of a storm. You just sit still, let it wash over you. And somehow life, I've seen, has a way of sorting itself out. Trauma has, the last 4 years, gosh, there has been some trauma there. But I've realized some things don't need to come to a conclusion right away. In my younger days, I would want instant this or that. Where do I go to? Where do I jump to from here?
Yeah.
Now I think I've become comfortable with discomfort over time, Jerry.
Mm.
And I'm just sort of finding the words and I'm talking to you. Yeah, I am comfortable now with being uncomfortable. Whereas at one time in my youth, I probably was not. I most definitely was not.
Mm. I think what I'm hearing, or what I'm getting actually, Jaspreet, from you is that you have developed, in a sense, the art of two things I'm hearing. One is that you give yourself time and you allow yourself space wherever you can. I can't quite imagine it in your life, but I can believe you. I believe you that you have to find these spaces, these moments where you literally put the foot down and put the engine in neutral, and you kind of just allow yourself to not do anything, but just to have space for yourself to process, even if that processing isn't necessarily cognitive. I think I'm hearing a sort of a giving of space. Am I getting close?
Yes, exactly. You've got it. Exactly. Yep. Just giving myself space, not wanting a way there right away, you know, a magic door opening.
One could almost say giving yourself permission to stare moronically into space.
You have described me to a T. I have seen occasionally my daughter look at me and goes, "Mom, where are you staring?" And nothing, just staring. Yeah, I've done that, Jerry. You describe it really well.
I think that's really lovely, because one of my areas of interest is the body. And I decry the fact that psychotherapy has been a sort of called the talking therapy. And I think many, many psychotherapists work in ways that people would regard as extraordinarily slow, that we often allow spaces and silences in sessions and nothing's happening. But to sit in that silence as a therapist took me a long time to learn. I felt I should be doing something. And over the years, the many years, I've become more and more comfortable with this idea of doing nothing. And this idea that our body, our nervous system, our whole being doesn't operate just from thinking things through and solving things. That there's a rumbling, grumbling process through the body, the nervous system, that somehow we just need to allow the shock waves of what we're going through to pass through the body. There's a kind of there's an aftershock and then an aftershock. And I hate to use that language because we've been through such a lot here in New Zealand with earthquakes, but we need to allow the tremors to pass through before we can necessarily understand what's happened.
Yes. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it took me a decade of trying to have my first child, my daughter. And that taught me there is things that, you know, you just have to let them be. This particular blood test, no, the numbers are not where they were needed. This particular hormone is not rising as quickly before I can do the next round of, you know, IVF and all of that. You just had to be able to deal with it, stay in the moment.
Yeah.
A very good friend of mine, she told me, just stay in the moment. Stop anticipating stuff. Mm. Stop looking back. You've just got to stay here. Otherwise, yeah, you're not going to be doing yourself any favors. So those 10 years, 10 very trying years, literally and figuratively, taught me a lot on how to cope. Yeah.
Staying in the moment and the image of being in the eye of the storm, that moment of stillness and calm in the middle of the storm, that links for me, that idea that we, by staying in the moment, no matter what's going on around us, the storm might be raging. Can we find that?
Safe harbor there.
Yes, yes, beautiful. Well, Jaspreet, thank you so much for sitting in the psychotherapist chair. How have you found it?
Thank you, Jerry. It's been very pleasant. Not the third degree I was expecting, I should tell you. But no, thank you so much. I'm honored to have spoken with you. And it's been quite a revelation for myself as well. I've been trying to find words to put what I want to in out there. So thank you for giving me the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.